Welcome to today's JNEB Journal Club webinar. I'm glad you're joining us for our presentation today. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of the Society for Nutrition, Education, and Behavior, SNEB. And I'll do a little housekeeping to get us started. Just a reminder that JNEB is the peer-reviewed journal for the Society. JNEB serves to advance nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. If you are not a member of SNEB, you are welcome today. And just a reminder that webinars are a benefit of SNEB membership. So if you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, there is the handout. The slides for today's presentation are there to download, so you can follow along with the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block, and we will moderate them to our presenters. When I close the webinar, there's a short survey. We appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future journal clubs. And then watch for an email follow-up, should be by Wednesday of this week, with a link to the recording, the handouts, and your CE certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. So I'll introduce our moderator. Dr. Kristen DiFilippo is assistant professor at the University of Illinois.
Thank you, Rachel. Today I get to introduce our presenters. Dr. Christina Scartozzi is a practicing physician, associate residency program director for family and community medicine, and assistant professor at Penn State Health St. Joseph's. In addition to having a passion for providing her patients with high quality primary care, she has a long history of working with the St. Joseph's reading community in both a professional and research capacity. Lisa Weaver is the Healthy Community Program Associate at Penn State Berks and Penn State Health St. Joseph. In her positions, she supports student and community social enterprise startups, manages the VeggieRx pilot program and corresponding farm stand, and facilitates a variety of additional lunchbox programming and strategic planning. A lifelong learner, Lisa brings her background in economic and community development and passion for sustainable business. Susan Veld here is an assistant professor in the departments of family and community medicine and public health sciences at the Penn State College of Medicine. As a prevention researcher and a registered dietitian, Dr. Veld here uses a social determinants of health lens to develop and test nutrition-related food as medicine interventions for adults in clinical and community-based settings. I want to thank all three of them for joining us today and sharing their work with us. At this point, I can hand it over to our presenters.
Great, thank you very much. So hello everyone, I'm Susan Veldier. I'm gonna start us off today and share some of the work that we've been doing in our Penn State Health St. Joseph's community-based hospital clinics. And I'm just gonna start by sharing this presentation is based on our published Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior manuscript, so you can check that out for more details. And here are the nutrition educator competencies. And just wanted to take a moment to thank our other team members who aren't here today who helped with this work, and our funders, of course, without whom we couldn't do the work. And so I'm going to start today by just sort of giving a quick overview. Some of you have probably heard of fruit and vegetable prescription programs. And in the initial phase of these programs, they started in the SNAP program. So they began with the idea that that people would purchase more fruits and vegetables if they had more money to do so. So Double Up Food Bucks program was one of the early adopters and groups that piloted these programs, where people could have, for every dollar that they purchased in fruits and vegetables, they could have an extra dollar at farmers markets. So then the fruit and vegetable prescription program sort of entered into the mix. And these are focused more in clinical settings and identifying people who have diet-related chronic disease. They may or may not be use income or SNAP as one of the criteria for inclusion, but but most often they include some sort of chronic disease, and they provide some kind of voucher or coupon or money for people to purchase fruits and vegetables at farmers markets or other retail outlets who will accept those coupons or those vouchers. So our team conducted a systematic review last year where we were asking about what kinds of programs do healthcare organizations specifically use to facilitate access to fruits and vegetables in their patient populations. And one of there were several different programs, six of them, insurance-based programs, gardens, community-supported agriculture, home-delivered meals, and clinic food pantry collaborations. But these fruit and vegetable vouchers took up the majority of the space in our systematic review. About 62% of the articles we reviewed were these kind of clinic-based programs. And there are a lot of reasons why healthcare organizations are starting to think about improving dietary intake in their patient populations. There are large organizations calling for screening of social determinants of health, so the National Academies being one. The Affordable Care Act also requires that healthcare organizations conduct community health needs assessments, and often the needs identified have to do with healthy lifestyle and diet. And then that leads to those organizations needing to do something in order to make a difference in their communities. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid are also sort of transitioning to value-based care, which also puts a responsibility on healthcare organizations to think about improving diet, since diet has such a large impact on health. And the National Institutes of Health has also established in their strategic plan identifying effective food as medicine interventions that can reduce the burden of poor diet, the clinical burden of poor diet. So there are a lot of different organizations that are thinking about these kinds of programs. And the question becomes, why would fruit and vegetable prescription or incentive programs be a good way to think about improving diet? So we know that higher fruit and vegetable intake is independently associated with better outcomes. Just fruits and vegetables alone can make a big difference on people's cardiovascular risk, diabetes, and a number of other health conditions. And that price is a key influence in food choice. But unfortunately, we also know that fruits and vegetables cost more than other lower quality foods. So there is a good economic reason why we might see that if you give people money to be able to purchase, and money in some form, to be able to purchase fruits and vegetables, they are more likely to change their behavior. So as we started to think about how would we like to present this talk today, our team really felt strongly that all the perspectives in getting a program like this running should be included. And so rather than just present the research outcomes that we have in the article in the Nutrition Education and Behavior, we're gonna also present the clinical and the community perspective. If you were interested in starting a fruit and vegetable prescription program, there really are a lot of pieces involved, and it really takes a team of people from several different perspectives to get them up and running. So we're going to do that today. We're going to start with the clinical or with the community perspective with Lisa Weaver, and then the clinical perspective with Christina Scartozzi, and then I will come back and talk about the research perspective. So I'm gonna start at the beginning, the inception of the program, with Lisa Weaver and turn it over to her.
Great, thank you, Dr. Valdir. Again, I'm Lisa Weaver, here to present a little bit about the context behind how this program materialized. Next slide, please. So the impetus for this program was driven by the hospital's Community Health Needs Assessment, or CHNA. And that process is mandated by the federal government for all nonprofit hospitals to conduct a CHNA about every 2 to 3 years. And this involves surveying community members, community leaders, stakeholders about the health needs and concerns in the community, which are then formally identified by the hospital, along with a subsequent community health needs assessment implementation plan on how the health system plans to address the priorities that surfaced. So in our community, over the past 8 years of doing these CHNAs, the diet-related chronic disease kept surfacing. And from 2018, a recent CHNA, the stats are presented here on the slide. Over 10% of adults in our community had diabetes. Over around 30% were considered obese. And so this related additionally to other research that was being done in the community by other partner programs, including the United Way from Berks County, where they did a data walk in one of the neighborhoods in Reading, where 50% of the heads of households worried about not having enough food, which is indicative of the larger, what I call, pandemic of food insecurity. And we know that food insecurity is directly linked with higher risks of developing chronic conditions. So the hospital asked, how do we address specifically obesity and diabetes, these diet-related chronic illnesses? Next slide, please. And how do we address them specifically in ways that are innovative and not duplicative of what other resources or programs already exist in our community? So there was senior leadership support for both financial and human resources focused on addressing these CHNA priorities in partnership with other community organizations. And we connected with Penn State University partners to research innovative upstream solutions. And that's when our research led us to the concept of a fruit and vegetable prescription program. And noting our existing partnerships with key players needed to make this type of program happen, we knew we had enough of an ecosystem to implement this type of program in Berks County. We received hospital board approval to pilot a fruit and vegetable prescription program at our outpatient clinic in the heart of Reading, Pennsylvania, what we call VeggieRx, and we received approval back in 2018, as well as IRB approval to study and research the impact on participants. And we piloted the program using the incredible resources of a national nonprofit called Wholesome Wave, and they basically wrote the book on fruit and veggie prescription programs. So they have a step-by-step toolkit that other organizations can use to implement their own version of this program. And so with technical support from Wholesome Wave, we structured a 7-month pilot program where eligible patients were enrolled and prescribed vouchers they could then redeem for fruits and veggies at participating farmers markets. They were then required to follow up monthly for nutrition education sessions, where they would then receive additional vouchers. And we collected a variety of pre and post program metrics, and including A1C, BMI, and blood pressure, as well as other surveys, more qualitative surveys. And the monthly amount each participant received was based upon their family household size, of the number of people living in their house that they were providing food for, which is a best practice recommended by Wholesome Wave. So the program not only benefits the patient, but the entire family as well. Next slide, please. Again, it was an IRB approved study, the program took place in our outpatient primary care clinic in the heart of Reading, Pennsylvania. The enrollment was significantly improved by one of our bilingual community health workers, since a majority of our patients here are Spanish speaking. And we had four eligibility criteria for the program that we as a team agreed upon. And so two of them are listed at the bottom of this slide. The patients had to be 18 or over, a patient within our health network, as well as having a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes with an A1C of 7 or greater and a BMI of 25 or greater. Next slide, please. And so just real briefly, the timeline here across the 7 months, initially patients were flagged for eligibility in the clinic. And then if they were interested in participating, they were enrolled on the spot immediately after their primary care visit. And then they were given their first allotment of vouchers, which then if they would come back for the subsequent monthly visits, they would get their next monthly allotment of vouchers. And then at the very end of the 7-month pilot, we collected some post-program data. And you can go to the next slide, please. A little bit more in depth about what we covered in those group nutrition education sessions. They were 1-hour bilingual education sessions with a registered dietitian, and again, attendance was required to receive the vouchers. We covered various topics related to healthy fats, carbohydrates, how to read a food label, what is a healthy portion size, and how to prepare fresh produce. And in these sessions, we also distributed bilingual healthy recipe cards. We did a variety of actual nutrition and food demonstrations where we cooked a healthy recipe and provided samples for the participants. I should say this picture was taken pre-COVID, but one of the comments that we received in the qualitative feedback after the pilot program was that the participants really enjoyed these peer-to-peer group learning environments. They wished they had more than 1 hour for these sessions. So that's something that we're considering moving forward with the program. Next slide, please. And they were then able to redeem their vouchers they received in class to buy fruits and vegetables. Like Dr. Valdir mentioned, a hurdle for many of the families is the affordability and accessibility of fresh produce. And so this was a way to essentially expand their purchasing power to be able to afford fresh produce at three markets representing four different vendors. On the left is a picture of an indoor year-round farmers market that they're able to spend their vouchers. And additionally, we decided as a health system to pilot our own internal farm stand, so patients didn't need to leave our building before using their vouchers. So to show you the evolution of how that came to be, the next slide shows you how we made that happen. Took a vacant room being used for storage and transitioned it over a period of about 4 months into our internal farm stand, which is a weekly farm stand that we're actually hoping to expand into a permanent retail location in our clinic. And finally, my last slide, if you can advance to the next slide, I just wanted to emphasize that this is a very, the program involves a variety of stakeholders to be successful. Of course, the pilot funding needed, which we received from our United Way of Berks County, and we're now being funded additionally by a CDC REACH program. And then of course, technical assistance from Wholesome Wave and the variety of vendors involved which contribute to the success of the program. We have their logos represented here. And then finally, additional community partners that support programming for the VeggieRx, including the Philadelphia Food Trust, which some of you might be familiar with. They have a satellite branch in Reading, and then our local chamber group is assisting as well. So with that, and I know I went a little bit quickly there, I think I'm gonna turn it over to Dr. Scartosi to share with you the logistics of how we implemented the program in the clinic.
Hi, everyone. As Lisa had mentioned, I'm Dr. Scartosi, and I'll be taking over the next section of the presentation to look at the clinical perspective and implementation of a program like this. Next slide, please. So as a clinician, what are we always telling our patients? Eat more fruits and vegetables. It's something that I say many times a day. I know that there are standards of care of diabetes self-management education and support. However, a lot of times our patients don't always get to those classes like we would like, and we have limited time for some of the robust nutrition education within our short visits and touch points that we have with our patients at times. And a lot of our patients tell us that there's different barriers to adherence, whether it's money, accessibility, transportation to get to some of those farmers markets, because Reading was considered a food desert. It was really hard to get local fruits and vegetables that were fresh. So Lisa and her team had really broken down a number of these barriers for our patients. So we were really excited to be able to partner with her for this program to bring it to our downtown clinic. Next slide, please. So we wanted to look at the benefit to our patients from a clinical perspective of outcomes, things such as hemoglobin A1C, BMI, and blood pressure, because we know these show metrics of control for our patients with diabetes. So this was really important for us to look at how a program like this could improve our diabetic outcomes. And one of the beauties that wasn't mentioned, or I'm not sure if mentioned earlier, was that we not only provided fruits and veggies to our patients, but Lisa's team was able to provide vouchers for the entire family. So we were wanting to change the entire family's nutrition to have better outcomes, not only for that patient, but their entire family. Because at times, if you provide for you know, a mother or father who's a diabetic, they might be giving those fruits and vegetables to other members of the family and not prioritizing themselves. So we wanted to make sure to limit that barrier as well. And we really wanted to increase their nutrition outcome related to their chronic condition so they can make better choices moving forward. Next slide, please. So one way that we made sure to help with implementation of the program was defining what we called champions for feasibility. So these were clinical champions embedded right in the clinic. So within our family medicine practice, myself and two family medicine residents who were passionate about this project, a dietitian in diabetic education, and the Spanish-speaking community health worker that Lisa had talked about. And what we really did was help develop clinical processes so that we can limit the impact of flow for all of our providers. We provided educational leads, so we did education for staff and residents, highlighted the benefits to patients, and really tried to make sure that the program was always in the forefront of and rallying to get patients enrolled. We did have a bit of enrollment visibility goal. The one that I have here for the carrot doesn't do justice to the poster we had, but it was like one of those little fundraising goals where you filled in as we enrolled patients to get to our goal of 100 patients, and that made it for a fun visual for all of our staff to make sure we're working together to enroll the patients. Next slide, please. So here was our clinical integrated workflow. So we needed to make sure that the processes were easy and sustainable. So it was really simple steps at each level, and every member of the team had specific roles and responsibilities. If we didn't take this on as a team project, I think it would have been harder to, you know, get our patients enrolled, but everybody had their little piece that added up to getting patients enrolled in our clinic flow. So the nurses would screen for eligibility, let the provider know that someone was eligible, briefly introduce the program, and the providers would then provide the prescription and flag the charts. And then we would get them onto the community health worker to finish up the enrollment process and get them scheduled for their first nutrition session, as well as give them that first packet of vouchers. Next slide, please. Here's another visual we had in clinic for what we call a preceptor room. So it's where all the providers come together in between patients to talk about their patients. And it was a visual that showed if their patients were eligible because they met the criteria, it kind of was a nice visual reminder to issue those prescriptions and flag the charts. So there were a couple different ways that we made sure everybody kept the program in the forefront. Next slide, please. So being education-based as our residency program is, we really had a community hospital that was focused on community engagement. So this is a great project for us to get involved in along with Lisa and the community. We do have ACGME, which is our accrediting body, requirements for scholarly activity for the residents. So this is a great opportunity for my residents to engage in a more system-wide intervention. And we had two residents, as I mentioned earlier, along with the community health worker, that helped us with data gathering. So they're really passionate about the program. So they'd look at the charts for recent A1Cs, blood pressures, and they'd make sure to get that data into our data capture system. And really the importance for me about this too is at the residency program, we're really training the family medicine docs of the future. So this is the workforce. So we want them to see and be involved in these type of interventions so that hopefully they'll have the foundation when they go out to be able to implement programs like this or connect with stakeholders for these type of programs as they move forward. Next slide, please. So as part of the program, I had an interest in, you know, a formal research evaluation of the program and knew that I needed some additional resources and more expertise to help us really conduct rigorous evaluation of the outcomes. So we had a community-based hospital, but we were affiliated with a larger academic medical system. So we reached out and connected with Dr. Susan Valdir. With her extensive research experience, she was able to help with the more rigorous research aspects of it. Next slide. So I'll pass it off to Dr. Valdir, who was our research expertise along with this program.
Thank you, Dr. Scartuzzi. Yeah, so I'm going to pick back up and share some of our evaluation outcomes. And, you know, as Lisa and Dr. Scartuzzi were presenting, I was just thinking about how really exciting this project is. It's not all the time or every day that a researcher gets to step into a community-based clinically relevant project. And so that's what happened here. As they were getting rolling, they asked if I would join the team to help with the outcomes evaluation. And so as we were thinking about that, there were some key questions that we had identified that we wanted to answer. So they are listed here on the screen, and we had associated questionnaires or data points that we could collect in order to answer these questions related to nutrition knowledge, the voucher redemption, clinical outcomes, and whether voucher redemption was associated with those clinical outcomes. So I'll share with you these findings. And just to remind you, we had a 7-month long program. So our evaluations were pre-post, baseline, and then follow up. The baseline blood pressure and weight were taken in clinic. The A1C was taken as patients were sent to the clinical labs to get their baseline and follow up. And at the end of the diabetes self-management education sessions, then the biomarkers were pulled from the chart. So we had a A1C pulled from the chart, and the blood pressures were either taken in clinic, or there were a few that were taken with about battery-powered cuff at the diabetes self-management education session. And I bring that up because it has an important implication a little bit later. So our final sample, when we were strict about our inclusion criteria that we had set up, was 97. There were a few enrolled who didn't technically meet the criteria, so they weren't included in the analysis. And we had follow-up measurement for nutrition for the nutrition knowledge of about 58% of the people. So those were given in the clinics. In the nutrition education, we had 98% of our data for voucher redemption and DSME attendance, and then 87, 92, and 93% for our biometrics. So pretty good data collection process here. Our sample at baseline was about 54 years old, majority female. Reading City is very high proportion of the population is Hispanic or Latinx. So that was represented in our clinics, and also low income. So we had a large group who were already receiving SNAP, and many comorbid conditions, current smokers, and almost everyone was on a diabetes medication at baseline. So let's look, does nutrition knowledge change? So they went through several nutrition education sessions, and these are some of the questions that we asked post-program, pre-program, post-program. So you can see in the data column there for baseline and post-program, we had quite a bit of shift in knowledge, people knowing how to use the program, basically, or the top four, where to buy the produce and what was grown locally sort of comes as the part of going to a farmer's market and seeing what's there. But we did have a significant improvement in how to prepare fruits and vegetables and the importance of eating fruits and vegetables on a daily basis. So that was good news for us. And then voucher redemption is an interesting question. There are, as we mentioned at the beginning, quite a few fruit and vegetable prescription programs that are currently in the published literature, but not so many have voucher redemption data, or they just have broad numbers. And so we wanted to dig into our voucher redemption a little bit, and we calculated this in two ways. The first way was just the straightforward, how many vouchers did we give out and how many were redeemed? And because the voucher, giving out the vouchers was dependent on whether people showed up to the session, that number changes based on who attended. But we also wanted to just look at a second way, which is assuming that the vouchers were given, regardless of whether they attended, and then look at that as a proportion of the redeemed. So we have the same N in this calculation. So we have actually 95 participants in our voucher redemption data. So this figure shows these different calculations. Also, we have our attendance. Here in blue, you can see the line, which is the attendance for our DSME sessions. So it started off higher and declines over time, which is pretty common. This is a pretty common attendance rate for DSME sessions. And then we have our redemption rate for that first calculation, which is just looking at people who show up. So if they show up and get vouchers and then whether or not they redeem them. And so this line is pretty high. We can see that when people show up, they tend to redeem their vouchers. It stays in the 80s to 90s and gets higher over time, really because the people who are coming to the sessions are going to redeem their vouchers. They're probably coming to get them. Maybe they're coming for nutrition education, but my guess is they're coming to get the vouchers. And then here is the line if you include the non-attenders. So we include all the people that enrolled in the program and assume that they got vouchers but didn't redeem them. And so you can see here that this line runs much closer to attendance. And I think that's probably the main point I'm trying to get here. Sometimes you see in other fruit and vegetable prescription program write-ups, their redemption rates are really high. But if you actually calculate the people that didn't show up, the rates kind of run with attendance. So did our clinical outcomes change? So our main clinical outcomes were BMI, blood pressure, and hemoglobin A1C. And here on the baseline column, you see where we started, the post-program values are the next column, and then the change I've highlighted in red here. So you can see that our systolic blood pressure actually went up and went up significantly, statistically speaking, about 2 units, and our hemoglobin A1C reduced significantly by 1.3%, which is about the equivalent of adding a new medication to a treatment regime. So that's a pretty significant, clinically significant, and statistically significant reduction. So let's look at voucher redemption and clinical outcomes and whether those things are associated. So this is a little bit of statistical modeling where we ran logistic regression to look at our biometric values, and we adjusted for other things. So we adjusted for age, race, ethnicity, gender, SNAP, the amount they were given, and where they live, the zip code, and just wanted to see what direction those biomarkers went in relation to voucher redemption. So what we saw is that as voucher redemption went up, that systolic blood pressure, it still increased. So that value that we saw previously, that didn't really change when we adjusted for other things. And the A1C decreased. So that one didn't, that was good. That good outcome didn't change even after adjusting for other things. But I think the most important thing here is in terms of A1C is that people who redeemed their vouchers saw better A1Cs. Now that systolic blood pressure finding, that's a little troubling. And what we gave it a lot of thought, and the thing that we're not so sure about is whether our blood pressure protocol was standardized, and we know that it wasn't. So in the clinical setting, you may have had a nurse who took a manual blood pressure with a cuff. We might have had an electronic blood pressure cuff that was used, or we know that sometimes the community health worker also took blood pressures in the DSME session at the end with a battery-powered blood pressure cuff. So 3 different methods for that blood pressure reading, which really leads to a implementation for future practice in terms of these kinds of programs. So we did find that voucher redemption and DSME attendance are very closely connected. And that leads me and our team to think about whether vouchers serve as an incentive to attend the sessions. And if so, thinking about how can we prove in attendance. If you remember that blue line on that figure, which was around the 50% range, how do we get more people to show up? Because those who showed up did better with their biomarkers, at least the A1C. And then thinking about consistent and reproducible clinical measurements. So in our next version of this project, we're going to be much more careful about our hemoglobin or our blood pressure collection methods and making sure that it's the same instrument that we allow patients time to sit and to rest before the blood pressures are collected, and those things that we know can lead to inconsistent blood pressure readings. And so with that, we've provided three different perspectives for the implementation of a fruit and vegetable prescription program, and starting with the community, the clinical, and the research. And at this point, we'd be very happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. It is really interesting to hear from the different perspectives. As people have questions, they can type those into the question box. One question that I have for you is, if someone were wanting to start a similar project, what recommendations would you have for them as far as assembling an interdisciplinary team like you did?
Who wants to start with that one? That's a really good question. I think if we had to, you know, Lisa and Chrissy and I have talked about this a lot, and if we had to do it, we would have to start, my vote, with Lisa. So maybe you can start, Lisa.
Sure. So I highly recommend, if you are interested, take time to sift through the Wholesome Wave toolkit, because it brings up questions you wouldn't have asked yourself. It brings up topics and suggestions from high level down to the minutia of what types of questions should you be asking on a survey, to pre and post program surveys. And I think for us, having that manual, it was, you know, security and credibility that we could bring to our senior management team at the hospital and say, this is a best practice type of program. There's a model for this. We're not recreating it from scratch. Using that as validation is very helpful. And then starting to think about, who do you have already in your organization or in your health system that shares the same type of, I guess, mission and motivation to do this program. I mean, we shared our why was the same, you know, because we were under the health system of trying to address chronic disease among our patients. So that's how we were able to pull in the clinic, specifically Dr. Scartosi in the residency program. But then having people like Dr. Scartosi that say, hey, this is going to be a little bit of work, but we see kind of the impact this can have, and we're willing to put in some sweat equity to make it happen. Because they're, quite frankly, depending how you budget, you might have finances to compensate people for being involved, you might not. So that's something to consider as well.
And yeah, I think Lisa did an awesome job engaging all those stakeholders, I think, before she even came to us. So she had a really great foundation and needed, you know, the clinical implementation. And honestly, for us, it was a no-brainer. It's great for our patients. They, you know, they need it. It's, you know, great for us to really, you know, help impact the system. So it really was sort of an easy choice on our part. I would, to be fair, and Lisa talking about, you know, time, being in education, so I have time for Scarlet Activity or, you know, admin time. So it was, and that's, I get to choose, you know, how I want to use it. So this is a program that was important to me. So I, you know, talked to the program director, and they were okay with me using my time as long as, you know, I got everything else taken care of. But for us, it's a little bit different because it's part of an expectation of my job to do Scarlet Activity. So it just sort of fit, checked a number of boxes. So sometimes in, you know, educational clinics, you might have a little bit more flexibility than others. But I would say with diabetic education, the senior management was more than happy to also allow the dietitian to have time, you know, for this program. So it really would be engaging that senior leadership to say, hey, this is important, and we have people willing to do it if you'll just give us a little bit of leeway. And we, you know, we didn't have any barriers in that regard, which really made the program able to be successful, and people take that sweat equity time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just add, from a research perspective, what our systematic review found was that the program, the existing programs that had been published, didn't have a lot of really rigorous evaluation, and that piece is very important. So it's easy to get excited for me anyway, about offering people fruits and vegetables and helping people to eat healthier so they can live healthier lives. But we have to have the evidence demonstrating that it actually works. And I think we have a first step here with this project, and there are others doing some really incredible work as well. But I would encourage folks to think a little bit about that, your evaluation piece, and how you're going to evaluate those hard clinical outcomes.
Yeah. And then one of our listeners says, very interesting study. Did you consider questions for participants related to their food preferences and cooking skills?
That's a great question. And in the sessions, I would say we certainly used references to what some of the typical kind of Latin dishes include, you know, other type of more tropical based produce or veggies that are maybe native to Latin America that we're able to purchase here locally to make them culturally relevant. But we did not include any questions on the surveys necessarily specifically about, you know, what type of produce would you like to see that you're not seeing at the farmers market? And we did not ask their kind of comfortability with cooking. I think that's something that we talked anecdotally about in class, you know, asking them, hey, who does the cooking in your household? Is it one of your family members? Is it you? How much control do you have over how much or what you prepare? But I think that is a great question for consideration moving forward and considering how to strengthen the program. And so we do now moving forward have a post-program kind of qualitative assessment for the participants to be able to provide feedback on what they liked and what they didn't like about the vendors. So some of that might surface.
And we're also planning some interviews with participants that will include getting their feedback on what could be different, what should we include. And I will say as well, what I think is really important about the program that Lisa and Christy set up is they had diabetes educators who are also dietitians teaching those sessions, but they weren't sort of brought in from somewhere else. They were dietitians who were really familiar with the Reading community and the patient population and certainly very seasoned. So likely they were very familiar and did bring a lot of that into their classes. Right. But there's always room to ask more questions about what we need to do differently.
And then another listener asks, when and how was consent obtained?
So good question. It was a long process to get their informed consent. We initially, the initial IRB protocol required them to do a formal written consent. So there was about a 5-page document outlining the protocol or the expectations for their participation in the program and everything that they can expect as far as their rights and that they were able to withdraw themselves from the program at any point, you know, every detail. And that form was conducted or filled out upon enrollment. So after the primary care visit, once they said they're interested in talking more about the program or learning more about it, they would then be facilitated. The enrollment process was facilitated with one of our community health workers. So she would explain the program more in depth. And then if they, again, said they were interested in participating, then she would go through the formal enrollment process where they would read the forms together. She would read the consent form with them, that 5-page document. They had to initial every single page and sign. And she had to really help with some of that because, some of our patients were either older or maybe had trouble reading at that level. So she really helped and was integral to the enrollment process.
And in the second version, we talked with the IRB about that and have now the new consent is not a full written consent, which will make things easier for everybody involved. And there's not really any information we're collecting that puts people at increased risk. So that was a good news when they reevaluated the risk level and rated it a little bit lower.
Yes, so great point. Thanks to Dr. Valdir's input, we were able to get that switched to implied or verbal consent.
And then Julia says, great presentation and a very clear summary of all your findings. Thank you so much, and we look forward to staying in touch and continued opportunities to partner. And then we have another listener who says, how did you coordinate meetings across all stakeholders and keep everyone informed? In addition, was there a research coordinator that helped organize the different elements of the project?
Yeah, so
we have regular meetings with different stakeholders. So Lisa had instituted regular meetings on Thursdays with a number of stakeholders, and we did not have a research coordinator. I think Lisa and the Community Health Worker, I think, did a lot of that background work. So they did a really great job of, you know, filling multiple roles for the team. And as the pilot continued, myself, Susan and Lisa actually meet biweekly every Thursday to kind of keep on board with planning. And then if we need to meet with a larger team, the residents, then we schedule those meetings as needed.
And I think that's part of what Lisa or Chrissy brought up as well, that, you know, as I work for Penn State College of Medicine, Academic Medical Center, there are some resources in that that we're fortunate to have because we're part of that Academic Medical Center statistical support, database support, and a few things that were needed to kind of pull the whole thing together, which is, I think, what really brought that third perspective. My perspective was just knowing where those resources are and how to access them and how to pull in the data that they had and then summarize it. Sort of brings it all full circle.
Yeah, it's a great point. We definitely wouldn't, the research aspect of it would not have been as advanced had we not brought in Susan and the resources she was aware of, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did participants share any barriers that they experienced to participating or redeeming their vouchers? And are there any ways that your team was able to or plan to address these?
Another great question. So the one farmer's market we showed you, the indoor year-round farmer's market, is located outside of the city limits. And so for some, driving there was a little bit difficult. And that's where having our internal farm stand was hugely helpful. Some of them could actually walk to our downtown campus clinic farm stand. Which is why to that point, we're trying to increase the amount of inner city bodegas, you know, corner stores that have produce, as well as grocery stores, to be involved in the program. So there's more locations inside the city limits that are easier to get to for our participants.
And then another listener says, nice presentation, great effort, and I'm glad you have more evaluation. I do not think you had a comparison group. Are there plans of trying to add a comparison group in future studies?
Yes, that's my job to work on that part, to secure some external funding. We have submitted some grants to run a clinical trial where we'd have sort of a standard of care group and comparing the VEGRX group. So yes, it's in the works.
Well, I want to thank all three of you. It's been wonderful to hear about your project, and I thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us. And thank you to everyone listening for all your great questions. And at this point, I can hand it back to Rachel.
Thank you. I was going to ask a question because I'm interested in the ongoing project that you said that was in the hospital. Is that going to be something available to like anyone at the hospital, or what are the plans for that?
Are you asking about the actual VEGRX portion?
Yeah. You're going to do a full farmer's market at the hospital?
Yes. Yeah, so the farm stand is actually, it was piloted in conjunction with VEGRX, but it's open to everyone. So even though VEGRX patients can come and redeem their vouchers there, it's open to everyone in the community. It's open to our staff. And so that's what I had mentioned. We're hoping to expand into a more permanent retail location to actually have part of our outpatient campus be retrofitted to include a healthy food store. So that's our long-term vision for it. It's something that actually also it addresses a variety of issues in the downtown community, including food insecurity, and it would be a part of a larger revitalization plan for our street. So it's an exciting direction that we're hoping to move in, as well as continuing, of course, to conduct the VeggieRx program and the research with participants.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you. Just a reminder to everyone attending that when I close the webinar, there's a short survey. We appreciate your feedback and ideas for future journal clubs. And then we should have an email out by Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording, the CU certificate that you earned, as well as the handouts. And then just a reminder, Journal Club takes a break next Monday, but our final session in our fruits and vegetables series will be the week following. So hope to see you back online in 2 weeks. Thank you.